Iowans with strong opinions and strong wills have played an important role in shaping our nation. Today, we'll explore the history of dissent in our state. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. During the Civil War, Iowa was a Union state, but there is more to the story. Wallace Heddle is an associate professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. He'll help us understand the different political forces of the time: abolitionists, Republicans, Democrats, and Copperheads. Then we'll move forward in time to the Vietnam War. We'll talk about the war protests in Iowa in general and the protest led by 15-year-old John Tinker in particular. That protest led to the famous Supreme Court decision, Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District, in 1969. John Johnson is also a history professor at UNI. He studied that time and that case. He'll be with us as well. Join us after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Iowa has always been home to people with strong opinions and strong wills. Today, we'll talk about the impact that some of those dissenting voices have had in our history. Later this hour, we'll focus on the Vietnam era, but we're going to begin deeper in history during the time leading up to and during the Civil War. My guest right now is Wallace Heddle. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. Hello, Wallace.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me on.
I want to start with the time before the war. Iowa was not a slave state, but not all Iowans were opposed to slavery. How significant was the abolitionist movement in the state?
Well, the abolitionist movement is relatively small compared to New England, say. Iowa at this time is still a frontier state, and urban areas are more conducive to that kind of political activity. But the abolitionists are, in Iowa, closely linked to the Republican Party and have a real impact on the world outside of Iowa.
Now, the Republican Party, of course, was the party of Abraham Lincoln. How strong was the anti-slavery plank of the Republican Party at that point, though?
The Republicans are founded in Iowa in 1856, and the one thing that's holding them together is a commitment to end the expansion of slavery. And that's very much the bottom line for Lincoln as well. There are other issues that the Republicans looked at. They wanted government aid to build railroads, very important to Iowa farmers. They wanted charters for banks, something that Democrats didn't like, but which was necessary to help develop an emerging market economy. So they had more than one issue, but slavery was ultimately the unifying issue for them.
I think there is a difference, though, that we need to make between wanting to stop the expansion of slavery and wanting to abolish slavery.
Very much so. Republicans didn't want to touch slavery where it already existed, but they saw the West as the future of the United States and as the hope for their children to have land. So they focused on the West, and they were kind of vague about it, but Lincoln especially believed that if you cut off the expansion of slavery, eventually it would die of its own accord.
Of course, this battle over the expansion of slavery was not just purely theoretical. It was very close at hand, and there was a big struggle over the expansion of slavery in Kansas. What was going on?
Well, especially Kansas. Republicans in places like Iowa hadn't expected the possibility of slavery in Kansas, and due to some machinations in Washington, it comes about that Kansas is going to vote on whether or not to have slavery. And that process of getting a political solution for Kansas spins out of control into what can be called a mini civil war. About 200 people are killed in Kansas in the 1850s over the slavery issue.
And how involved were Iowans in that struggle?
Well, very much. One example of that, and this is an example of how Republicans could cozy up with abolitionists, is the example of James Grimes. Grimes was the founder of the Republican Party in Iowa. He was the first Republican governor of Iowa. And he meets with a man named James Lane. Lane represented the New England Emigrant Aid Society. And this was a group committed to funding young men who wanted to move to Kansas and helping arm them as well. So Lane goes to Grimes and asks for help. And Grimes says, well, I can't help you militarily, of course, but I have a meeting, and I'll have to leave right now. So Grimes leaves the room, leaves a key on his desk, and that key was the key to the state arsenal. So this abolitionist, James Lane, ends up getting 1,500 weapons from the Iowa government, something which was secret at the time and had to be illegal in some way or another.
Well, certainly. When did that come to light?
After the war. It took a while, but after the Civil War.
Another very famous abolitionist also was involved in the Kansas struggle and found himself in Iowa, and that was John Brown. What was his involvement in Kansas?
Well, first, I should say that John Brown is one of our most famous abolitionists because he led, in 1859, a failed raid on Harper's Ferry, Virginia, against a federal arsenal. That's what he's most famous for. But he's got a strong Iowa connection. In the mid-1850s, Brown decides he wants to fight in Kansas. So he goes out there, and he is outraged by what's going on there. There's an event called the Sack of Lawrence, Kansas. Lawrence was an anti-slavery town. A pro-slavery mob comes into Lawrence, breaks windows, scares people, burns a couple of buildings, and Brown decides this must be avenged. So Brown and several men who were following him, they went to the campsite of some settlers from Tennessee who were not involved in the Sack of Lawrence exactly, but they were from Tennessee and they had committed that sin. Brown separates the men from the women and children and orders his followers to hack the men to death with broadswords. Now, there's a lot of ways I wouldn't want to go off this planet, but I think, you know, getting hacked to death with broadswords is one of the worst ways you could die.
When John Brown came to Iowa, and if I know my history correctly, John Brown spent a lot of time before Harper's Ferry, before all of this, traveling around the country raising money.
Yes, he does. And he's a fugitive after the events in Kansas, mm-hmm. for understandable reasons. And he first comes to Iowa. He's looking to recruit men for his mission to Harper's Ferry. He's looking to raise money. And the first place he goes is Tabor, Iowa, which is in the far southwestern part of the state. And Tabor had been settled by graduates of Oberlin College, which was an anti-slavery college in northern Ohio. It was the first coeducational college in the United States. And Tabor was a stop on the Underground Railroad. So Brown found refuge there for a while. Eventually, they were unhappy with him, because he led a raid into Missouri to try to free slaves, which was viewed by the people in Tabor as a bit reckless.
He found refuge among Quakers in Iowa, which surprises me because Quakers are a peaceful people and John Brown wanted to fight.
Yes, the Quakers were the earliest abolitionists in the United States, the first people to want the end of slavery immediately. And they were also pacifists. And squaring those two principles was a very difficult thing for them to do. Brown ends up, they were sympathetic to Brown, even though he was what he was. Brown goes especially to Springdale, which is in southeast Iowa, in Cedar County. And there he recruits several residents to his gang, and he also drills the men in a kind of amateurish way. Now, people in Springfield, this is a Quaker community, Springdale rather, it's a Quaker community, and people are torn. Several people there join Brown's group. A couple of others, though, I suspect that John Brown's plan had become an open secret in town because a couple of people from Springdale anonymously write letters to the War Department urging them to do something about John Brown because of the impending raid.
When John Brown led that raid, that unsuccessful raid on Harper's Ferry, how many Iowans did he have with him?
There were a total of 21 men, and six of them were Iowans, which is remarkable considering that the strongest areas for abolition were in the East, and that Brown himself was a resident of New York State.
And that's Harper's Ferry was a long way from Iowa as well.
It was a long way, and they had to be funded by people from mostly from the East Coast. But there's a remarkable story involving two brothers who followed Brown to Harper's Ferry. And these were a pair of Quaker brothers, one's named Edwin Coppock and the other one Barclay Coppock. Now, when the raid happens in 1859, it's a disaster. It's poorly planned. It is based on the false assumption that slaves are going to rise up when Brown comes to West Virginia. And it doesn't go well. Edwin Coppock is captured, tried, executed. But Barclay Coppock's job was to guard the escape route out of Harper's Ferry. And therefore, when the raid fell apart, Barclay Coppock runs, and he manages to get out of Virginia and to go all the way back to Springdale, Iowa, which probably wasn't the smartest place for him to go. Virginia authorities come looking for him, as you would expect, and they try to extradite him out of Iowa for murder and treason. If he'd been extradited back to Virginia, he would have certainly faced the death penalty. So it's a very tricky situation. And here's where some of the radicalism of the Republican Party comes in. Samuel Kirkwood, who's a Republican governor at that time, and the man Kirkwood Community College is named after, Samuel Kirkwood gets these extradition papers, and he says, well, these aren't exactly right with all the legal P's and Q's. So why don't you come back and get us better extradition papers? So the Virginia authorities don't have a choice. They come back with more watertight papers. And by that time, someone in the governor's office had gotten to Barclay Coppock, and Barclay Coppock was in Canada.
We'll talk more about the voices of dissent during the Civil War in Iowa in a moment. Right now, my guest is Wallace Hedl. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. We've been talking about abolitionists and Republican voices before the Civil War. We're going to take a look at the other side. There were many other voices as well. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about the history of dissent in Iowa, and we're taking a look in particular at two time periods when dissent flourished. And the first we're talking about is the Civil War period. In a few minutes, we'll move forward in history and talk about the Vietnam era. But right now, my guest is Wallace Hedl. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. And Wallace, we were talking a lot about the abolitionist movement in Iowa, the Republicans in Iowa. Let's take a look at the other side of the issue and talk about the Democrats. And I think before we talk about the Democrats, we should define the parties a little bit better because, of course, Democrats and Republicans then are very different from Democrats and Republicans now.
Very different. The Democrats were nationally largely based in the South, and they tended to be very cautious about government aid to things like railroads or banks. They were skeptical about the emerging market economy. Because of their Southern roots, the Democrats were also more phobic about African Americans than Republicans were. Republicans weren't entirely racial egalitarians, but the Democrats carried racism a step further. You can see that in the 1840s, Democrats are a majority in Iowa. They have migrated up here from places in the southern Ohio Valley, like Kentucky and southern Indiana. And as the state's just getting established, they pass so-called black laws. And among other things, what the black laws do is to require any African American entering the state to show free papers and also to post a $500 bond, which was supposedly to guarantee against their becoming a ward of the state. So the Democrats were quite racist, and that's kind of a nasty memory in Iowa politics.
Were those laws enforced?
Yes, they were. The population of Iowa in 1860 is almost 600,000 and 200 total African Americans. So, yes, they were enforced, and the environment was not friendly, particularly in river cities like Dubuque or Keokuk that had trade links to the South. They had imbibed pro-Southern prejudice, and they acted on it.
Iowa wasn't a particularly active part of the Underground Railroad. Is that one of the reasons why?
Well, the Underground Railroad does exist in Iowa, and it's mostly run by a small group of Quakers and Congregationalists, both small religious groups in Iowa. It's very hard to say how active Iowa was there, though, because most of what we know about the Underground Railroad is published after the Civil War. And, before the Civil War, the Underground Railroad was illegal.
It was underground.
It was underground. It was dangerous to participate in it. And after the war, everyone wanted to claim that they were involved in the Underground Railroad. But we do know that places like Tabor and Grinnell, Iowa, were stops on the Underground Railroad for some people.
There was a movement called the Copperhead Movement. Tell me about the Copperheads.
The Copperheads are also called Peace Democrats, and they are opponents of the war. They are a large minority within the Democratic Party, and they tend to be concentrated in the bottom two tiers of Iowa counties, the area near Missouri, and also in the river cities like Dubuque that have connections with the South. The Copperheads believed that the war was unconstitutional because it hadn't been declared by Congress. Many Copperheads were Irish Americans who feared that freeing the slaves would bring a wave of black immigration and cost them their jobs. So the Copperheads, they're also against the draft. And in general, they're against central power. So they're strongly opposed to the war.
What role did the Mississippi River play in this movement? The Mississippi River, of course, was at that point the easiest way to travel largely and the easiest way to move goods to other places. But it was closed down during the war.
It was closed down. The Mississippi was responsible for 25% of Iowa's agricultural exports. The rest left by rail. And 25% might sound like a small number, but if you lose 25% of your exports, you've got a big problem if you're a farmer. So in places that where trade flourished, and that's all up and down the Mississippi, Dubuque, Burlington, Keokuk. Those were hotbeds of Copperhead sentiment. And the union has this real challenge to open up the Mississippi. There are Confederate forts all along the Mississippi at the start of the war, and that means no trade. And farmers in the Midwest, not just in Iowa, but across the Midwest, really depend on the Mississippi, and their morale is going to suffer if the Mississippi can't be open. Ultimately, it is open in 1863, 2 years into the war.
There were a lot of Democrats in Iowa when it came to support for the war. How did that break down? Were the majority of Iowans in support of the Civil War?
Well, overwhelmingly, Iowans were in support of the Civil War. Majority of the Democratic Party supported the war. They had problems with emancipation. They had problems with a number of Lincoln policies, but they supported the war. And Republicans, of course, were overwhelmingly for the war. One measure of this is that 49% of young men of military age in Iowa served, and the vast majority of those were volunteers. So Iowa is very enthusiastic about winning the war.
What happened to the Democratic Party in Iowa as the war progressed and eventually the North won?
Well, the Democrats don't do well at the ballot box, and part of the problem is the continuing embarrassment they have about the Copperheads. Give you one example. Dennis Mahoney was an Irish immigrant and the editor of a paper called the Dubuque Herald, and he was a vociferous opponent of the war. Now, this is his case is one that raises tricky questions in regard to civil liberties. Mahoney was about to be nominated as a Democratic candidate for Congress in 1862, and just before that happens, federal authorities, suspend the writ of habeas corpus. And I'm going to toss over to my colleague John Johnson the task of explaining how habeas corpus works. John's a constitutional scholar.
And John Johnson is also a professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. Hello, John.
Yes, good morning, Charity.
Thanks so much for being here. So you're on the spot now. Tell us about habeas corpus.
Well, habeas corpus is a standard procedure to try to deal with difficult questions of whether a person is properly charged for something. And throughout the Civil War, this was a measure that was attempted in different parts of the country for peace Democrats, for people who were protesting the war. And there were some major court cases on this. And President Lincoln basically lost most of the cases.
So back to you, Wallace. What was the impact of that on the state of Iowa?
Well, in Mahoney's case, it's remarkable. He's arrested, shipped off to the Capitol prison in Washington, D.C., and 7 days later, the Democratic Party nominates him for a seat in Congress. Now, Mahoney is never charged with a crime. He's never told what he's done to go to jail for. He spends 3 months in prison, and this 3 months coincides with the period that he would have been running for Congress in. 2 weeks before the election, he's released, never told why he's released. He comes back to Dubuque, goes back to his newspaper. He's embittered, and, of course, he loses the election.
That is hard on a campaign if you spend the entire campaign in prison, I would guess.
Yes.
So after the war, what was the political climate like in Iowa?
After the war, the Democrats aren't looking good. They had flirted with disloyalty all the way through the war. The Republicans have now won, and they were a majority in Iowa before the war. Iowa Republicans urge soldiers, especially ex-soldiers, to vote the way they shot. And they do. Republicans are the overwhelmingly favorite party in Iowa. Iowa becomes one of the most Republican states in the country. And it remains that way all through the time that memories of the Civil War remain.
And I love the saying that you shared with me in an email a few days ago, that Iowa will go Democratic when hell goes Methodist.
Yes, that pretty much captures how strong Iowa was as a Republican state.
Well, Wallace, thank you so much for filling us in on that history. And I do want to move forward in time now and talk with you, John Johnson, about the Vietnam era. During the Vietnam era, in the lead up to the war and in the early days of the war, what was the political climate like in Iowa?
Well, Iowa, like a lot of the country in the early 60s, was not thinking so much about the war. There were other issues. Of course, civil rights dominated. I tell my students that the Vietnam War before probably late 64 was a back page story. It certainly didn't appear very often on the front page. And it took the Gulf of Tonkin resolution in 1964 and finally the escalation that began late 64 and early 65 to bring the draft calls up and subject young male Iowans and other young men across the country to the draft. The war was quite supported popularly across the country. The New York Times, which would later become a critic of the war, was strongly in support of the war early on. The first big protests came in the fall of 1965. And a group of Iowans joined many others and went to Washington around Thanksgiving. And that was the genesis of the anti-war movement here in Iowa, as I see it, and led up to the famous armband case that I've been interested in for quite a while.
Well, let's talk about that armband case. And this happened. John Tinker was a 15-year-old boy, and this happened in December of 1965. What did John Tinker do?
Okay, John Tinker was one of the small contingent of Iowans who took a bus to Washington, D.C. for the protest. And on the way back, he and other adults and young people who were there talked about what they could do to sustain the protest here in Iowa. And John's father was a Methodist minister who was on leave to the American Friends at the time. His mother was also an activist. The Tinkers had been in Iowa, in different parts of Iowa, before settling in Des Moines in the around 1960. And they were part of a peace community there that included Quakers, liberal Protestants, Unitarians, some Catholics, and students at nearby colleges and universities. So he was part of a small protest group. And his sister, Mary Beth Tinker, would also be figuring in this court case that I'll talk about.
And when did the conflict arise? Again, you mentioned there are many adults involved in this movement, many college students involved in this movement. And when we think about the protests of the Vietnam era, those are the groups that we think about. But John Tinker was still in high school.
That's right. He was 15 years old. But he and his parents had traveled around Iowa and other places in the Midwest. They were active in a number of causes, civil rights, peace causes. They were in favor of banning the atomic bomb. And John and Mary Beth would hand out literature at the parents' tables. And so they sort of grew up marching. And John was, even though 15, was someone who had been thinking about social justice for probably most of his life.
How did they bring those politics into their schools?
Okay, well, this gets us into the armband case. We're actually approaching the 45th anniversary of the facts in the armband case very quickly. After coming back from the protest in Washington, the students and some of their parents talked about how to keep the feeling going. And someone, and we're not sure who, came up with the idea of wearing black armbands to school on certain days in the 1960s. The initial motivation for the armbands was twofold. One, to mourn the individuals who had so far died in the Vietnam War, both Americans and Vietnamese. And secondly, to support the measure that the late Robert Kennedy, had proposed for a bombing halt around Christmas. And so the young people thought that this would be an interesting idea, and So some of them, in mid-December of 1965, wore armbands to school, and that was the beginning of probably the signal event of Iowa protests in the 1960s.
We only have a moment before our break, so we will talk more about this after the break. But very briefly, how did the school respond to their armbands?
The school district, the Des Moines Independent Community School District, attempted to head this off by passing a resolution a couple of days before the planned armband protest to ban the wearing of armbands in protest of the Vietnam War. And that generated some interest on the part of the students. Some anger, an attempt to write letters for the student newspaper involving people in the community. The Des Moines Register ran a story the day before the first of the armbands were worn. So people were being sort of prepared for something. And then when we get to December 16th and December 17th, a number of students wear the armbands.
And we'll talk more about what happened at that point in a moment. John Johnson is a professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. He is also the author of the book, The Struggle for Student Rights, Tinker v. Des Moines and the 1960s, as well as many other books. We're talking about the history of dissent in the state of Iowa. And if you have memories of the Tinker case or other memories you'd like to share, give us a call, 866-780-9100. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and today we're talking about the history of dissent in the state of Iowa. We talked earlier about the Civil War period, and now we're talking about the Vietnam era. My guest right now is John Johnson. He's a professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. He's also the author of the book, The Struggle for Student Rights, Tinker v. Des Moines and the 1960s. And before the break, we were just about at the climax point of the protests led by John Tinker and his family. So on that day that the students were planning to wear armbands to school, what happened?
Okay, on December 16th, which was a Thursday of 1965, and I'll bet there are some listeners out there who remember the news coverage, Chris Eckhart, who was one of the named plaintiffs in the case along with the Tinkers, and Mary Beth Tinker wore their armbands to school. They were dressed very nicely in Mary Beth in an appropriate length skirt and a white blouse with her black armband. Christopher wore, I believe, a sport coat. And they didn't create a whole lot of stir. There were some questions. Chris went to the main office at his school, Roosevelt High School, and basically turned himself in, saying this is a protest at civil disobedience, and I have broken a rule that the school board has just passed, and I want to test that rule. Mary Beth wore her armband most of the day, and until the afternoon, no one commented upon it. Maybe there was some talk at lunch, but it wasn't a big deal. John Tinker didn't wear his armband until the following day on Friday. And he also didn't meet a lot of criticism. Basically, the two of the three kids were suspended, and one of them was simply sent home. John was the one who was sent home and not officially suspended. But there was talk in the school, more stories in the newspaper, and it became an issue of interest. The student newspaper wrote about it, the Register, the Old Des Moines Tribune, and it became topical throughout Des Moines.
It sounds like a fairly quiet protest. How did it turn into a court case?
Well, that's a good point. I call it a genteel protest. If you compare it to things that were happening on college campuses in New York, Madison, Wisconsin, Ann Arbor, Michigan, Berkeley, California, this was pretty tame stuff. It turned into a court case because the school board of the Des Moines Independent Community School District voted to uphold the suspensions, and the students, through their parents, went to the Iowa Civil Liberties Union and asked them to take the case and test the constitutionality of the the restrictions in Des Moines. And a young attorney named Dan Johnston was the attorney that the Iowa Civil Liberties Union retained to represent John Tinker, Mary Beth Tinker, Chris Eckhart, and initially two other students. The other two students dropped out. So the named plaintiffs in the test case were the two Tinkers and Christopher Eckhart.
It took a number of years for this case to be resolved by the Supreme Court. What happened during that time?
Well, what happened during that time is that the Vietnam War became the story in the country. The Tinker case, the facts begin in the fall of 65, and the decision doesn't take place in the Supreme Court until February of 1969. And listeners and people who remember the era realize that the escalation took place, the death toll went up, protests escalated around the country, college campuses in a few cases exploded. Virtually all college campuses had some protests, and it became a much bigger story than it was in 64 and 65. And so when I look at the case, I look at it, the Tinker case, in comparison to what else was going on in the country. And it's one of the few high school debates, one of the few high school cases that attracted attention. Most of the violence and the emotion was poured out over the college protests. So by February of 69, the war was the big story. We had a new presidential administration. The Johnson administration had officially begun the war, but the torch had been passed, so to speak, to Richard Nixon and his administration. And by the time of the decision in February of 1969, there were over 530,000 American soldiers in Vietnam. And it was the overriding issue in the country. And so when the Tinker case came down, it was talked about and pretty much in juxtaposition to the violence on college campuses.
We'll talk more about the impact of the case in a moment. But David's on the line in the Quad Cities. He called 866-780-9100. Hello, David.
Hi. I just wanted to mention this. As the professor was relating the story of the Tinker case and the way they approached it, I had a good friend in high school, and we went to Waterloo, a high school in Waterloo. And in 69, in the fall, we decided we'd wear black armbands. And we found the teachers didn't know how to take us, and we were actually pretty nice or, you know, fairly good students and or no problems ever. And there was never any follow-up, partly because at that time in Waterloo, I couldn't get anyone else to join. And then I was kind of lost as a 17, 18-year-old. I didn't know what to do. But I just was following the whole protest thing, thought that I wanted to do something, but didn't know how, which being in a blue-collar town such as Waterloo, I was pretty much out there, way out there on the left. But it was extremely life-changing for me and very interesting.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that story, David. And, John, that gets us right to our question. What was the impact of this decision when the Supreme Court handed it down?
Well, I appreciate David sharing his comments. His experience must have come about the same time as the actual decision in the Tinker case. Well, as most of your listeners know, the Supreme Court, by a vote of 7-2, supported the student protest and found that the actions of the school board were inappropriate and violated the Constitution. And in the majority opinion written by Associate Justice Abe Fortas, the Supreme Court said that the Constitution does not end at the schoolhouse gate, that constitutional rights are available to young people in schools as well as adults. The decision in some ways was predictable because it was, as I said, a very genteel protest. There was little disruption in the schools. Dan Johnston said that the school district had difficulty demonstrating that there was any disruption. And as a result, the Supreme Court decision said that this kind of symbolic protest was constitutionally appropriate as long as there's not substantial disruption. And the school district could not prove much disruption. There was some finger pointing and some cat calls and a few incidents. I mean, we, after all, had 18,000 students in the Des Moines schools then, so lots of things went on. And I have heard from many Iowans since I published the book you mentioned, and there are many stories. But by and large, the situation didn't lead to much violence or even disruption of the classrooms. Some people said that it was a good teachable moment. And so when the Supreme Court decided the case, it was a fairly easy decision for the majority, the liberal Warren Court majority, to come out with the decision it did, because you had a clear political protest, which was done without an attempt to embarrass or intimidate or disrupt, and there wasn't much disruption that occurred. So when the decision came down, there was substantial support, I would say, amongst Iowans. Not universal by any means, but it was a fairly popular decision, and a common thread that you saw in the news coverage and the letters to the editor was that this was preferable to what was happening in a violent form on college campuses elsewhere. The Tinker decision really was a victory for responsible civic action, in my opinion.
Jim is on the line from Eldridge. Hello, Jim. I think
hello.
Hello, Jim. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I had a case in Adel, Iowa, when I was a kid in high school, and Dan Johnson also represented me from the American Civil Liberties Union. And, did he ever receive any recognition for all the work that he did in those years?
I can answer that. Thank you, Jim. Dan has been back to Iowa several times, and he has been feted at reunions. There is a play that I believe just opened in Des Moines on the Tinker case, and there is a character, of course, who plays Dan. Dan received at least one award along with the Iowa Civil Liberties Union for its First Amendment activities. And Dan Johnston talks, I've talked to him a few times over the years, and he said that for a young lawyer, this was basically his first case, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and he won. And he jokes that ever since then, his life has been downhill.
What happened to the other characters in this story? What happened to John and Mary Beth Tinker and Chris Eckhart?
Okay, well, let me start with Chris, because he's the one that who's often left out, Chris or Christopher, as he prefers, would go on to a very interesting life. Chris was more politically active and more of a leader than either of the Tinkers, and he was involved in student groups and in more protests. He would he would go to school in many different universities around the country. He'd receive his baccalaureate degree finally in the 90s. He resides in Florida, I believe. At least that's where he last was. And he's always been sort of a rebel. Shortly after the decision, he actually ran for office in Des Moines and was defeated. But he's the most politically active and forceful of the three. Mary Beth, who was the youngest of the three at the time, went with her parents to Missouri, and she was, as she put it, a little bit soured on education, and for a time was a piano tuner working with her hands. But then she went into nursing and has made a lifelong career as a nurse. John Tinker has been a peace advocate. He, for a time, built old computers and sent them to developing countries. He's participated in a lot of reunions. But they're all interesting individuals. They've gone different ways. they're now, let's see, 45 years later, about 60. And so they're hardly young people anymore, but I thought of them as the kids, but clearly they're not kids any longer. The history has gone a long way since 1965.
Well, I'd like to bring Wallace back on here as well. Wallace Hedl, an associate professor of history at UNI as well. And I'd like to ask each of you, from what you know about history in Iowa, what do you think the role of dissent is in the state? How has it shaped Iowa? And Wallace, I'll let you go first.
Well, I think it continues to the present day that Iowans are a skeptical people. In spite of the example of John Brown, if you look at the whole sweep of Iowa history, you're going to find that Iowans are generally in their protest activity more like the Tinker case. They're civil, they're polite, and I think that's what makes us a good state to run things like caucuses in.
What do you think, John?
Well, I would certainly support what Wally just said. One of the threads that interests me in what he was saying and what I've mentioned is the place of Quakers, and both the Civil War protests and the Tinker case involved Quakerism, a gentle protest, the sense that you don't change things overnight, but you have to start somewhere, and you have to start with the hearts and minds of a few people. So, you know, the message to me of at least the protests that I'm familiar with in Iowa in the 1960s and 70s is that, yes, it's appropriate to dissent if you have strong feelings. You need to do it responsibly, and you need to respect the other side, and you need to play by the rules. And that's pretty much what happened in the Tinker case.
Now, I know that both of you focus on history, so the present isn't really your field of expertise. But
well, Charity, I am the present historian,
right, okay,
at UNI. I'm talking about things as recent as the morning newspaper, but I'm an exception.
All right. Well, John, then let me ask you, as you look at the political climate today, where there is a lot of rancor and there are many dissenting voices, there's a lot more shouting than we've experienced in the past in the political climate of today. How do you see Iowans and their role in these dissenting voices like the Tea Party today?
Well, I think Iowans are part of the nation, and there is rancor and incivility here, but perhaps less so than other places. I think we have a responsibility to try to express our views, but express them civilly. And I think the commercial, maybe for the Regents Universities, Iowa, Iowa State, and University of Northern Iowa, we sponsor a number of forums and discussions and panels, and we try to deal with controversial issues in a responsible and a respectful way.
Well, John, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Charity.
John Johnson is a professor of history at the University of Northern Iowa. He's also the author of the book, The Struggle for Student Rights, Tinker v. Des Moines and the 1960s. And Wallace Hedl, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Wallace Hedl is an associate professor of history at UNI. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Phil Moss in Cedar Falls. Send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the program, Life After Cancer. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
Election Day is closing in, and while Chet Culver and Terry Branstad are capturing most of the headlines, there are four others running for governor. Monday on The Exchange, we'll speak with third-party candidates Jonathan Narcisse of the Iowa Party, Libertarian Eric Cooper, David Rosenfeld of the Socialist Party.